So we are at the MIT Media Laboratory with Cynthia Brazil, who is director of the Personal Robots Group here, and has also set up a new Center for Future Storytelling, a new initiative that we'll get to in a minute. Let's just pop back a minute, because we just both got back about a month ago from Deauville in France at the Women's Global Forum, and we did a session on changing life as we know it, including enhanced human brain computer interfaces. And as I look around, there's just all these stories turning up all over the place on robots. This has been going on for a long time, obviously, since Star Wars and so on, which got you into this business, but suddenly it's very much on the front pages again. Has been some development that makes it more likely that robots like Nexus, yeah. Nexi behind you and so on are really just on the verge now of becoming human companions?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the media hook has been, if there's been a bunch of new articles coming out recently. I mean, I think we are definitely at this very exciting time where there are big societal challenges facing us that certainly within the robotics community, we see a lot of relevance. So certainly one of the big domains is elder care. How can you create technologies that can provide people with not only physical assistance, but cognitive assistance? Robotics could be intriguing, especially social robotics could be an intriguing technology to help people live independently longer. We're seeing in areas of therapy, people trying to explore again the use of robotics to help people achieve motor rehabilitation goals. Even within the area of autism, the use of social robots as a therapeutic intervention to help try to teach children social skills and abilities. The aspect there being that, you know, the human face can be overwhelming, but social robots are essentially a simplified social stimulus that you see these behaviors that children engage in, social behaviors that you may have never seen before with another person, starting to come out with these robots. And so the idea is, could the robots be somehow used as a scaffold to help train those skills and pull the child along? Ultimately, hopefully, to face-to-face interaction. So I think, you know, the thing that's new and certainly a lot of the area that my work has contributed to is appreciating that these robots, when you think about robots with anthropomorphic qualities, have interesting social implications, that they somehow evoke people's ways of social thinking and interaction, that their value to people could be beyond just physical work, labor devices, which a lot of robotics is focused on, to having social affordances that could help people achieve other kinds of goals like educational goals or health goals through social interaction. So this area of socially assistive robots is coming out. And I think in many ways, you know, when computers were first developed, it was really about specialists using them for specialized applications. And then the personal computer was all about, well, how do you design these systems so anyone can interact with them? And I think robotics, when we talk about personal robots, robots coming into society, the same questions are arising now where, you know, the average user is not going to be an expert in robotics. They're not going to program these robots in the way that the specialists do, but anyone's going to have to be able to interact with them. They're going to have to be able to help people with a wide, you know, difference in backgrounds and so forth. And how do you design robots that truly anyone can use? So robotics could become a ubiquitous technology. And one of the areas that we've been discovering is the social interface could be a universal interface. If you can design robots that already push our social buttons, that people already anthropomorphize in a way that is intuitive for people to interact with, to understand, to communicate with, then that might be a real sweet spot for how to design personal robots. And so I think there are applications coming out or that people are thinking about for robots that, you know, even 10, 15 years ago, we never would have thought of. So it's an exciting time.
So Back in San Diego, I'm part of the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center, which mm-hmm. is a science of learning center funded by the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. And it deals with the science of educating. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the PIs is Javier Mavayan, mm-hmm. who's a colleague and friend of yours. Mm-hmm. And they had Javier has the robot, Ruby, yep. and he's also got a new one coming in right now. I'm picking up on your comment here about the use of robots as part of an educational community.
Sure.
There was a piece in the Smithsonian Magazine recently about Javier's work. Mm-hmm. Now, what's the basic thesis here? I mean, are we talking about robots? I know that having watched Ruby, that once they got the facial expressions right, that the robot became a useful learning tool mm-hmm. within their community with small children. This is not replacing teachers,
right.
is it?
Yeah.
Can you speak to that? Because some people say, oh, why are you having these machines replacing teachers? You
know, I mean, I think it's unfortunate that often in the media, the knee-jerk reaction is, oh, you're trying to remove something, replace somebody. When in reality, when we develop these technologies, we're trying to augment and empower people. So again, when we think about interesting technologies for children and learning, I think especially for very young children, robotics is intriguing, and I think it's exactly because of their physical and their social affordances. So when you think about how children learn in the world, I mean, it's profoundly social. There's a lot of physical exploration. There's physical manipulatives. There's physical artifacts. I think, again, robotics as a technology could be designed to, you know, basically be in the sweet spot of how children learn in the world if properly designed. So, you know, in some of my work on a robot called the Huggable, the question there... The Huggable, which is designed to be a learning companion. The first facet of that we're exploring is thinking about robots as a communication technology, robots as an avatar, to allow someone like an educator to physically be someplace else, socially be co-present with someone else at a distance. So, for instance, when we talk about learning a second language, the best time to learn a second language is as early as possible. And again, we know we learn language through interaction, through actually trying to apply language. We know that just watching a television show and hearing the language isn't sufficient for us to be able to learn it. We have to try to use it. We have to be in interaction about it. We know that nonverbals and eye contact and gestures and all these play an important role in how we communicate and is engaging. So it's intriguing to think about a robot as a communication technology that would allow, say, a second language teacher to be face-to-face, co-present with the child, talking about their books, their toys, interacting in physical space, doing eye contact, directing attention, doing everything that you would expect, but allowing somebody who could have expertise, who might be a long distance away, actually be able to be there and provide children with that service, to basically, you know, broaden the participation and make those experiences more accessible to children who might not have them otherwise. So they're thinking about, you know, for our research, not only what's the experience that has to transpire between the physical co-present robot and the child to make that learning possible. What does that robot have to physically be able to do to make that an engaging interaction? I think the really intriguing thing there is that robot, because it's not human, could be a fanciful character that could transform that relationship, that learning and teaching relationship, be one of more of a peer-to-peer sort of relationship rather than an adult-to-child where they might be embarrassed to make mistakes, less willing to take risks, to one that's really more of a peer-to-peer relationship. So I think that, again, that robotic embodiment can afford a different learning style and different learning relationship that could be very beneficial for a young child trying to learn, you know, say something like a second language. Similarly, the other side of that work is really thinking hard about what are the interfaces that need to be in place for the remote teacher as they're kind of jacked into this robot so they can see through the robot's eyes, they can hear through the robot's microphones, they can speak through the robot's mouth, they can control the expressions, they can control where the robot looks in a very intuitive way. So they're not focusing on the operation of the robot, but really just being immersed in the interaction. So there's a lot of work we've put into thinking about the nature of those interfaces to be as natural and intuitive as possible. And one of the key things that we're finding is that the semi-autonomy of the robot becomes very critical in terms of mitigating that cognitive load. So for instance, you could have in the case of trying to maintain eye contact, say, with the child when you're talking to them, having a face detector run on the robot, that the robot takes care of the tracking, that the person doesn't have to explicitly control that, is like one of the techniques that we've been exploring, sort of offload the low-level operation of the bear to the autonomy of the robot and allowing the person, the remote operator, to direct the robot at a very high level in terms of look here or say point here, and the robot figures out the actual control to point at the point where you'd want the bear to do it in the real world.
Okay, so but describe the actual physical setup here. What are we envisaging here? I mean, you've got a child who wants to who's learning the language. Mm-hmm. You have the robot, which is interacting with
face
the child.
Face to face. Yeah.
You have somebody remotely.
Could be across the country, potentially across the world. Yeah, a teacher.
Who's a particularly good teacher.
Who's particularly good. Yep.
Essentially channeling in through the robot.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Do you have anybody else there? Is there another teacher present?
It could be, absolutely. Absolutely. Could be parents, could be other teachers, absolutely. So, again, in a preschool setting, you would expect there to be other children, other teachers around there.
Right.
Even in a home setting, you would expect that, you know, a caregiver would be there, a parent would be there.
And the robot has the capacity to read facial expressions?
So, well, you could imagine doing a variety of things. So if the remote teacher is seeing through the cameras of the bear, they could be interpreting the facial expressions because they're getting the video signal. But what they might not be able to do is sense how is the child, say, perhaps touching the bear, because we know that if it's a teddy bear, if it's something soft, I mean, there's going to be a lot of communication through, say, social touch. The sensate skin on the bear probably at that point needs to do an automatic classification of those touch patterns and notify the remote operator what those are, because the remote operator obviously can't feel that. So that would be one example of a recognition on the perceptual level of what's transpiring in the face-to-face interaction that the remote operator would want to be aware of. But certainly things like, you know, the nice thing about that that paradigm is, of course, I mean, human teachers are incredibly skilled. You know, so you want to leverage all of the experience and the wisdom and the skill of human teachers in the system, but you want to enable them to reach perhaps a much broader range of children than they might otherwise. You could imagine in the future, potentially, if you could record all of those interactions, understanding what's being said in what context, what cues are being used, teaching styles, learning styles, if you could capture that enormous corpus, you could imagine over time perhaps learning a model, a cognitive model of pedagogy, that potentially in time that robot might be an autonomous learning companion as well, so a person doesn't have to jack into it in order to do the teaching. It could be an interesting research direction in its own right, and at that point, you know, that's a technology that potentially could reach, you know, millions of children, given that you don't have to connect a specific person to a specific child. So that could be empowering as well. But I think, you know, for us in the big picture, we always want to think in terms of how can these systems supplement, augment, empower the human social systems to help children learn, to improve abilities for teachers, to reach more students in need, rather than trying to replace teachers. Yeah. The other thing that these technologies can also potentially do is quantify those interactions to give teachers a much more fine-grained quantitative understanding of how the child is learning and performing over time, which again they could use as feedback or information to improve or reflect upon the curriculum or what they want to do with the child next. So the robot can be an empowering technology and the ability to record these interactions and analyze them or help the teacher analyze them. So they have a much more quantitative way of understanding the progress of that particular child as well. So I think there's many roles that a technology can play in basically helping teachers and educators do their job. And for the child, I mean, you can imagine this is it's a playful, fanciful, engaging interaction. So,
which I assume, from what I've read at least, is the response you had when you were, before even your teens, where you saw Star Wars,
of
right?
Course, yeah.
So for many kids, C-3PO and R2-D2, playful, engaging.
Yep. Captures the imagination.
Is that what
Absolutely.
Started you off on this, you think?
Well, you know, I think it's funny. So, you know, going through it during, you know, in real time, so to speak. I mean, at the time I saw stores, it wasn't so much like, that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I mean, I did all kinds of stuff. You know, I played tennis. I mean, I was doing all kinds of stuff. And looking back, I can tell you this very coherent story about how this led to this. You know, but in reality, as you're going through it, I mean, you're doing all this, all these different paths. But certainly, if I point to, I think, a very influential moment in my life, given what I do now, Star Wars, absolutely. Not only me, I mean, many, many, many of my colleagues. Science fiction is often what inspires us to want to go into careers in science and technology. I mean, it captures our imagination of what's possible. It fascinates us, and we want to explore that and try to create that. I think I'm not certainly the only one, the only Star Wars junkie, you know, age 10 or whatever, who ended up going into robotics as a career. I think if you look at the nature of the robots that I build, the idea of robots really as socially, emotionally expressive, more like characters and personas rather than sort of the all-knowing information device. It was really interesting for me seeing this sort of shift in, you know, even from my advisor, Rod Brooks, and how 2001 and HAL was his inspiration for AI and what an AI system would be. And I didn't see 2001 until I was in graduate school. My first exposure was more like the Star Wars. And so for me, my perception of what robots were these, you know, creatures, essentially, that could engage people in meaningful relationships, that cared about people, people cared about them, they would help each other. I mean,
they had a sense of humor.
They, you know, were sidekicks. I mean, that was my expectation of what these machines could be growing up. And then when I did see HAL in 2001, I'm like, who would ever want to build a system like that? You know? But, you know, so it is kind of really telling how these early experiences can really shape your vision of what could be possible. And again, you look at the robots that I build, and a strong focus of them is that the interpersonal aspects of them.
There's two things. Well, one is whether in fact the vision that the original pioneers of AI, artificial intelligence, had has actually been realized or not. But let's put that aside for a second and deal with the second part, which is you're talking about the emotional content that, that goes along with the robotics that you do. Mm-hmm. This is very interesting. One of the things that we talked about at the Women's Global Forum was the need for there to be, or how desirable it would be for there to be more women in science, and you always say, and engineering.
Yeah, engineering.
Not just science. You know my position on this, that it's almost, I wish that organizations like Women in Science and Technology didn't have to exist, and perhaps the best thing would be to make themselves redundant, so you don't even think about how odd it would be for women to be in science and technology and engineering. But given that, and given the situation that we have at the moment, when women do go into engineering, a great number of them, certainly the stars, have gone into robotics and dealing with this personal robotics thing. I mean, is this this is obvious to you? I mean,
Is it obvious? I mean, I think certainly if you look at the field of human-robot interaction and social robotics in general. I mean, it's still a male-dominated field. You know, there's many, many men that do it, but certainly in terms of percentages of women, it's much higher. And you're right, in terms of a lot of the leadership, there's many more women who are pioneering it and being the thought leaders as a percentage, I think. And
I give you an example. Yeah. I mean, this is MIT's technology review, which looks at 35 innovators under 35. One of them here, Andrea Thomas, with whom your PhD student, you were in this book some time ago.
Yep.
the current issue of New Yorker has a story by Jerome Groopman called Robots That Care. It's about Maya Matarich, another colleague
fellow
of yours.
Absolutely.
Women working with robots. Yeah. Here's Simon, the robot, that are useful social adjuncts. So I rest my case.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it does go to show that, you know, if you want to foster creativity, you need diversity And you need diversity in ways of thinking and ways of knowing in terms of disciplines, but also people from different backgrounds, different genders, different races. I mean, I think this is all critical. And I think what you're seeing, certainly the gravitation towards social robotics, is women's desire to bring the technology in contact to people to help improve everyday people's lives. I mean, I think that that's a big motivator of that. So you're starting again to see robots in their social skills able to actually be effective in helping people address, you know, weight management goals or physical therapy goals or learning goals. When you have different perspectives, people from different backgrounds, different interests, everyone benefits. And I think it is absolutely essential that we as a nation figure out a way to encourage many more girls to pursue careers in science and technology and engineering, and to grow up perceiving themselves as, you know, I build things, I could be an inventor, I can solve problems creatively, I can build stuff, I can build really cool stuff, you know. I think there's far too few experiences now for girls to really express that. And I think there's huge opportunities to come up with new experiences, even we think about new toys and so forth, to just allow, I mean, kids in general, but certainly when you think about broadening participation, that would reach children, appeal to children, where maybe, you know, shoot 'em at video games or robot competitions don't quite, you know, spark their imagination. I think there's much more that could be done.
There's a letter here in the Howard Hughes Medical Institute bulletin, written by Tom Check, who was mm-hmm. recently president of the Howard Hughes on Women in Science. Mm-hmm. When we were in Deauville, we were given these magazines. Mm-hmm. This is Forbes Woman, Mythbusters, who says women can't do math and science. And then this is the one in French, Le Pouvoir des Femmes, mm-hmm. 50 Women Who Are Successful, and so mm-hmm. on. So I think there's certainly a shift. But you talk about getting a climate in which more girls mm-hmm. automatically see no problem in just pursuing careers in science. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to your background. I mean, your parents were both scientists, right? Though, right? I mean, what kind of scientists? What did they do?
Well, so they were computer scientists. So they worked with computers. I mean, they did a lot of computer engineering sorts of projects and endeavors. So I was definitely raised, I mean, I was raised fortunately in a family where, you know, my parents made it very clear that, you know, the world was open to me. I could do anything. And my key to doing that was education. And it was they understood that, you know, the key to opportunity was you need to know your stuff, you need to learn, you need to know how to learn. And with that, you can be empowered to do anything. So that was critical. That education was revered in my house was critical. And they also very much understood the opportunities that careers in science and engineering offered, that they could be creative, that they could be rewarding, that they could be fascinating. You know, they deeply understood what the opportunities were, and they definitely, I can tell you, not so subtly, encouraged me to excel in science and technology, and I mean sports and all these other things too. But
and you were good at that. You could have done that.
I was fortunate to be good at a lot of things. Yeah, and I think frankly sports was a huge part of my being able to excel in a male-dominated field too, because you just learn through sports a self-esteem and a confidence, the understanding of training hard to be excellent at something. You know, in many ways, when I talk to kids, I try to emphasize, it's like, you know, being smart in many ways is just like being a great athlete. It's something you work at. It's a process. It's a skill. It's not something that's just innate. You know, you have to work at it. And like anything else, if you work at it, you'll get better at it. And I think far too many children, at least in this country, think that being smart's, you know, a trait where either you are or you aren't. And, you know, I was fortunate to be raised in a family where it was about effort. It was about effort, and you could always improve. And it was a skill. Everything was a skill that took practice.
So what's the heritage here? Were your parents born here? Where does the name, it's an unusual name, B-R-E-A-Z-E-A-A-L,
yeah.
Brazil?
Brazil, yeah, that's how we say it. Yeah.
But where does it come from?
Well, we think it's French. So, you know, if we trace back, you know, my ancestry, I mean, both my mother and my father come from multiple generations of Americans. So even my mother is from Korean descent, but even she was like second, you know, generation on her mother's side and third on her father's side. My father's ancestors, we believe, came from France, like, you know, in the 1680s, you know. So very American. I am very, very American. And, you know, my parents met at UCLA, and both math majors. You know, this was before computer sciences, of course, was a major, and they were kind of at a time. And, you know, probably my mom was one of the first women pursuing computer science, you know. And
So did you know, when did you know that you were going to go and study science? I mean, or is this?
Well, you know, I think, you know, as with many young women, my interest in high school, I was actually thinking more in terms of medicine. I thought maybe I would be a doctor or something like that. And my parents basically said, you know, if you major in engineering, you can still go to medical school if you choose to do that. But if you choose not to do the advanced degree, you can still get a great job as an engineer. So I thought, well, you know, that's pretty sound advice. I'm keeping all my options open. If I decide I don't want to pursue the advanced degree, I can still get a really rewarding occupation. So I decided to major in electrical engineering. And, you know, as I got into the subject material, it turned out at UC Santa Barbara, there was a Center of Excellence in Robotics. And so I got more into robotics while I was there. And it was when I was about, I'd say, a junior in college, I decided what I really wanted to be was an astronaut. And so
An astronaut,
yeah. And so I thought, well, I need to get a PhD. I'm going to be a mission specialist. I need to get a PhD in an area that's relevant to being an astronaut. So I thought robotics would be one of those areas. So then I got, you know, the idea of PhD in robotics, and I ended up getting into MIT. And it turned out that the project that was just starting up in Rod Brooks's group was to develop micro rovers. And this was a time before Pathfinder, before NASA was thinking about many small rovers to do planetary exploration. So it was a great match and interest. And in a lot of that work, and in fact, you know, Rod Brooks is credited with sort of, you know, getting NASA to really think about changing the way they use robotics in terms of these small rovers. And some of the projects that I worked on was kind of the early projects in that direction. So. I did some, you know, some collaborations with NASA as a graduate student, and.
So what happened to the astronaut bit?
You know, I mean, the bottom line was I was just having such a great time building these robots. That kind of like that Star Warsian vision kind of got back into my head, and I thought, you know, if we're ever going to see robots like in Star Wars, it's going to start in a lab like this. This is the place it's going to happen, because, you know, at the time we're building these kind of insect-inspired robots. And it was they were all biologically inspired, a lot of the algorithms. You know, I would study insect locomotion in order to design walking algorithms for these robots. And I just got really into it, you know. And again, it was kind of that aha, you know. It's like, if these robots are ever going to fit that vision, I mean, this is the place. And so it's kind of like, you know, history follows, you know. So we started with these insect robots. Rod went on sabbatical one. This was around 1993, and he toured the world, and it was a time when Japan was starting to develop, they already were developing humanoid robots, but they were concerned about the growing elderly population issue. So humanoid robotics was becoming much more prevalent there. And this was before everyone knew that Honda was working on humanoids. I mean, a lot of this was still pretty early. And Rod came back and he goes, okay, no more insects, no more doing humanoids. And we thought, what? Because we thought we're going to go from, you know, insects to iguanas to dying. We thought we're going to go up the evolutionary scale. But nope, I got one big project left in me. We're going to go for humanoids. So we started thinking seriously about humanoid robots. And of course, a lot of that was, you know, robots in human environments. Mm. A lot of our environment is engineered for this morphology. You know, so if you want to create a technology that can use the same tools and implements and navigate spaces, probably the human form makes a lot of sense. And of course, I was thinking also in terms of, well, now they have to interact with people. you know, rather than going up to Mars and navigating Mars, that's a very different situation than navigating the downtown streets of Manhattan, right? So it opened up entirely new questions in robotics that had really never seriously been asked before.
And I read that child development was one of the things that was Absolutely. A driving engine for your thinking at this point. Where does Kismet fit into all of this, by the way?
Yeah, so, you know, for me, again, thinking about this morphology not only interesting in terms of, manipulating these human-made artifacts, but the social interface. How are you going to interact with people in a way that's natural? So I started thinking a lot about the role of expression and face-to-face interaction. And, this was, again, before any of this work existed. So, you know, where are you going to start? You know, it's like, well, let's try to start modeling in some sense the simplest social interaction, human-like social interaction we can imagine. And for me, that was, you know, a mother with the newborn or young infant. You know, that's kind of where it all starts. That's where it all emerges. Let's start there and try to model that, where the idea was the robot was essentially like an infant and the human was like the parent or the caregiver. And of course, you know, as a mother of three children, I know firsthand, as well as all of the scientific literature, a lot of the earliest communication starts from the expression and sharing of emotion. You know, and these nonverbals, eye contact, all this stuff. It's like, you know, first we start off, it's all face-to-face, and then we start to be able to move her head around and sit up and pick up objects, and then eventually we can start to walk. But it's like there's a reason why we develop in this progression, but it starts off with the face-to-face and the communication and the sharing of expression and emotion, and that what the infant comes into the world with are these proto-social responses that encourage adults, caregivers, to treat the infant as a full-fledged social entity, arguably before we have the cognitive, social, developmental apparatus to really be a full-fledged participant. But we treat our infants as though they are, and it's from those interactions that we develop and learn how to become full-fledged social participants. So it's sort of this bootstrapping process that became a really fascinating paradigm to explore. So the question with Kismet was, what do you start off with? What are the precursors? What are the innate abilities that start you on this path of being treated as a social entity, where now it's a robot? It doesn't look anything like a human baby by any stretch of the imagination, but cues like, you know, large eyes and diminutive stance and so forth, this kind of Kinshin scheme or baby scheme, were intentionally put into that design to encourage people to treat the robot at least like a young creature, and to engage in these playful, face-to-face, very expressive interactions, and appreciating that, you know, there's, you know, things called motherese and motionese, where we exaggerate our gestures, we exaggerate our facial expressions, we exaggerate our prosody in a way to make it easier for the infant to perceive and understand the intent of what's being communicated. By making the robot like an infant, people did the same behavior. So it simplified the perceptual problem for the robot to try to be able to recognize these things, to engage in the interaction.
Yeah. So why did you call this robot Kismet, by the way, which means fate, right?
Yeah.
Any idea?
Yeah, I mean, there was a whole kind of art to naming robots, in the group. And basically, I wanted a name that was gender neutral, that wasn't strongly associated with, you know, either being a boy or a girl. And I wanted something that sounded kind of fanciful and kind of gadgety, you know. And I couldn't do it Gizmo, because that was already in that movie Gremlins or whatever, you know. So I thought, well, maybe Kismet.
Okay.
And then Kismet stuck. Yeah, Kismet stuck.
While we're talking about this, the one behind you is called Nexi, right?
Yeah.
What's Nexi's claim to fame? What is this one doing?
Wow. Well, so yeah, Nexi's fame is kind of like skyrocketed. So, I mean, in the evolution of the robots throughout my career, I mean, in many ways, they've kind of followed this developmental paradigm where first there was Kismet. It was just an expressive head robot. I mean, it was all just about the face-to-face.
But that really puts you on the map. Oh,
well, it started the whole field,
yes.
Right? And then the successor of Kismet was a robot called Leonardo,
right.
And that was a collaboration with Stan Winston's studio. And Leonardo was an extremely expressive robot.
I'll just interject, Stan Winston, of course, the very famous movie.
Animatronics.
Animatronics.
Special effects animatronics. Does that, yeah. So a master in how you build extremely expressive robots, a lot of artistry in how to make that happen. And so Leonardo was exploring a different aesthetic, and it was no longer looking like gears and mechanics, but it was a much more organic, creature-like appearance. But Leonardo now had a body. It had arms that could gesture, and it could manipulate very simple objects. So in many ways, like an infant, now you had the body that could sit up and start to interact with things. So it's not just about this, but this in the context of all this other stuff. So we've pursued a lot of research with Leonardo, looking at learning new skills and abilities through tutelage, looking at learning through imitation, starting to probe what it would mean for a robot to have a theory of other minds, social understanding of people in terms of not just your actions, but your underlying mental states, your thoughts, your beliefs, and so forth. And then Nexi represents yet another level of evolution, where now it's a much more dexterous robot. Its arms have a much larger workspace, and it's a mobile robot. So whereas Leonardo was kind of bolted to a base, Nexi can actually move through space. So now Nexi, in many ways, is kind of like, you know, the mobile toddler that can actually move through space and manipulate objects and still have an expressive space to interact with people.
So it occurs to me as we're talking about this how Darwinian this is, in the sense of one of Darwin's famous texts, of course, The Expression of the Emotions. Paul Ekman, mm-hmm. of course, very well known for doing
absolutely.
Work on expression of emotions. Mm-hmm. The series that's on television right now called Lie to Me, which is kind of built on Paul's work as somebody who's able to read facial mm-hmm. expressions and so on. All this is interestingly yeah. connected, isn't it?
So yeah. I mean, we've certainly, you know, I've read a lot of the psychological literature, and not only underlying emotional models, we would say, and we're developing these computational models that are inspired by various theories within psychology, but also how those are coupled to and interact with how they're expressed through facial expression, through gesture, through prosody, through multiple modalities, body posture. In fact, we draw inspiration from beyond science. We draw inspiration from, you know, cartooning and animation as well. So if you look at our robots, I mean, some of them are pushing more of the kind of human-inspired literature, you can say, and some are definitely right in the middle of animation and cartoons, where squash and stretch and these totally different ways of moving and expressing can be employed, but nonetheless, people understand it. They understand the emotion being expressed. So, I mean, the design space is actually quite huge. We've designed robots that don't have faces at all. Like, you know, Luxo Jr. would be an example of that. So, you know, Pixar's icon, Luxo Jr., is a little desk lamp. Highly expressive, anthropomorphic, but a lamp. We actually built the robot lamp inspired by that. That was a kind of a collaborative lighting assistant. There was actually even a performance that was performed in at MIT in the Kresge Theater, written for a robotic lamp as a thespian. So, you know, again, taking inspiration just from arts and expression, we know that it doesn't have to be like a human to be really expressive for people to be able to infer these internal states.
Right.
It's really much more about how they move and how they react and how they respond. And so again, the design space is actually enormous. And people know me probably for the more explicitly anthropomorphic robots, and often these furry robots. But actually, we've designed robot flowers. I mean, all kinds of stuff. Because the design space is fascinating. It's very large, and there's a lot of opportunity there.
When you spoke to our friend Neil Tyson mm-hmm. at Nova Science Now, again, this may be one of those things that in retrospect looks like it was a milestone in your thinking and development. But there was this story about when you were in third grade at Livermore, you wrote a story about this kind of kleptomaniac robot that was forever stealing things, right? I mean, what was that about?
You know, I don't even remember. It wasn't until, you know, so the National Academy of Sciences sponsored a book series called Women's Adventures in Science, and I was one of the initial 10 women profiled. And, of course, they asked my mom for just things, you know, as my childhood that they thought might be noteworthy. And so I had totally forgotten about this essay. But mothers remember these things. And they published this essay. And I mean, looking back, I was talking about, and this robot had emotions and they were implemented on a computer. And I thought, man, I was pretty perceptive in the third grade. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you were looking way back when. Yeah, it seems like I was definitely in that space. But, I mean, I had totally forgotten that until I saw that essay, and actually even in the book.
You know, part of this background is also the Asimov and science fiction stories, Asimov's rules for robots, the laws and so on. Here's a current issue of a magazine called Philosophy Now, which I occasionally pick up. And as you can see, the cover is Moral Machines. And there's several essays in here about the whole notion of machine morality. And this was obviously something that was talked about years and decades ago, but again, here it is, coming back again. The challenge of moral machines. Mm. Will robots need their own ethics? Four kinds of ethical robots, machines and moral reasoning. How machines can advance ethics. Is this something that you think about as well?
Well, absolutely. And again, I think probably the reason why you're starting to see a lot more of these articles is because with the success of the Roomba and variety of, you know, best-selling toys and so forth. I mean, I think
the Roomba is the little vacuum cleaner.
You're starting to see robotics actually enter into the home of everyday people, and that is a big milestone, right? So first in the nature of toys, but then these sort of appliances that, you know, become a little more autonomous and a little smarter. So, you know, I think people see that. I mean, it's coming. It's coming, and so. What are the implications, as with any new technology, what are the implications of this, especially if we're applying these technologies in social contexts to help elders live independently longer or to help with health goals or educate? I mean, these are very sort of social, human realms where, again, in the past, robots had kind of been thought of purely as a physical labor device. And now it's entering into the social world of people, and of course there's going to be a lot of debate and reflection on what are the implications of this, and what's the ethical, responsible way to develop these technologies that, you know, maintain human dignity and where we feel they're, you know, we're applying the technology in a socially responsible way.
I'm just thinking though that the Asimov, Isaac Asimov story. He had the three laws of robotics that were to allegedly appeared in his handbook of robotics dated 56th edition, the year 2058 AD. Mm-hmm. Law number one, for example, a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm and so on and so forth. But 2050, we're getting there a lot sooner than he was thinking about, right?
Yeah.
It's coming down the pike very quickly here.
But I mean, of course, the reason why is largely probably because of his books. You know, he put the seed long before these technologies were getting into the home. He posed the questions and gave some intriguing thought experiments. So, I mean, he is the reason, I think, in many cases, why we're thinking about this earlier than he was.
One of the things you said to Neil was, which intrigued me, your living room is the final frontier for robots. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, partially a joke, but partially in all seriousness. I mean, robots have been exploring the depths of the ocean on volcanoes and been into outer space. And I mean, they've been pretty much everywhere. And then the final frontier that we don't really see them prevalent yet is in human environments and in our very living rooms. And I think there's a good reason for that. I mean, I think when you consider the complexity of the human social environment where robots have to be able to be adept in their interactions, not only with objects whose behavior is governed by the laws of physics, but people and animals whose behavior is governed by having brains and minds. I mean, that's just an entirely whole set of new issues and complexities and nuances that we hadn't even thought about, really. And you think about, I mean, again, just the complexity of that environment, it's a tall order. You know, when you think about how long it takes even for us as people to develop theory of mind and language and all of these things. I mean, of course, in relation to machines, it happens incredibly rapidly. But still, I mean, it takes years to develop these social skills and competencies. Even, you know, so my oldest son is in kindergarten. A lot of the education that they're going through is how to socialize. How to get along with others, how to manage conflict, you know? It's a lot of what they're actually learning in early on that's going to be critical to the success as adults. takes us a long time to learn these things. It's complicated.
Has thinking about how to implement that kind of thing in robots helped you as a mother?
You know, so the funny thing is, I mean, I was certainly sophisticated enough to know that all the journal papers that I would ever read about developmental psychology was not going to be the same as being a mom with my own child. I mean, I just knew that going into it. I think, you know, certainly reading a lot of the literature and trying to build these things into machines certainly really deepened my already pretty substantial appreciation and kind of state of awe in terms of what we do as people, you know, what's possible and how hard it is to try to get that to actually happen within a machine. But certainly, I mean, I think, you know, just appreciating the absolutely critical role that parents and the social environment plays in our own cognitive development, and what a stark contrast that was to attitudes in AI and robotics, where it's like, you know, you program the robot, you stick it in a room, and it's supposed to kind of just learn everything by itself through bumping into walls, and, you know, of course, it's just going to magically happen. And how that's just not at all how we do it. You know, we are so dependent on benevolent caregivers who structure our environment for us, who give us feedback, who direct our attention, who take all of this crazy complexity around us and help us filter through that in a way to learn what's important in an environment that's safe, where we can take risks that are okay if we make mistakes. There's a huge amount of social scaffolding that takes place in order to help even us, with all of our innate abilities and biology and so forth, to be able to go through that development. And how vastly unfair it was for us as researchers to think we could just lock a robot in a room and have it all figure it out for itself. You know, so just appreciating that, I think, it was really eye-opening for me. And then, of course, being a parent and, you know, seeing it unfold, you know, before my eyes with my children, I mean, I think certainly just appreciating my role. And I mean, a lot of it, I think just happens naturally. We're kind of predisposed to do these things. But, appreciating, you know, the stages of development of my kids, you know, was great, because I knew the literature before then about, you know, about now they should be recognizing, you know, being able to mimic or do certain kinds of facial expressions or laughing. I mean, just knowing that all these things kind of come out in a time course was really fun. Yeah.
If you hadn't been a scientist, and certainly there are a whole bunch of things pushing in that direction with your parents and so on, if you hadn't been a scientist, can you think of what other career you might have chosen?
If I hadn't been a doctor either.
Oh, I read somewhere that you
maybe
wanted to be...
Maybe I still would have been an astronaut. No.
Well, I read somewhere that you wanted to be a veterinarian.
Well,
this
so
is
before that,
story.
Yeah. So I loved animals growing up. Love, love, love animals.
So you've got robotic animals.
Mm-hmm.
All over.
No, I loved animals. So absolutely, there was a time when I was interested in being a veterinarian. There was a time when I was thinking being a professional tennis player would be pretty cool. So, my interests, you know, were all over the map, I think. Sports was a huge part of my upbringing, a huge part, my relationship with my dad in particular. I spent a lot of quality time with my dad training for various athletic activities. And again, I think, you know, I was fortunately good enough in a lot of sports where I could compete quite well with the guys in my classes too. And that certainly, you know, I experienced a level of respect from them because I could do that, especially on the tennis court. And I had a comfort level with competing with and against guys throughout my entire childhood, that when I ended up going in engineering and I was one of the few women along a lot of guys, it just didn't faze me. I think it just didn't faze me in the way that it fazed a lot of my female friends. I think sports is a sort of interesting side effect. Very influential, I think, in building, again, the confidence and the self-esteem and being used to be treated with respect from, you know, both genders, and expecting to be treated with respect from both genders was just part of who I was. And I think a lot of it was because of sports.
Now, your husband was quoted as saying she's fearless and she will try anything. So that comes from the sports, probably.
Well, I think for sports and just from my upbringing, having just, you know, incredibly supportive parents I was raised with the attitude that you could do anything. And I think being very fortunate to have mentors, you know, such as, you know, Rod Brooks as an advisor who gave me, I mean, tremendous freedom to explore my ideas. You know, I think the most motivating thing for kids is to have someone who really believes in you and says, you know, it's possible and I believe in you to try. And, you know, I think that's when we do our best work, is when we're allowed to really pursue our passions and feel like there are people who we really respect who want us to succeed and believe that we can succeed and are there to help us succeed.
There's a couple of books with a very similar title. One's by Sir Peter Medawar, called Advice to a Young Scientist. The other one was by Ramon y Cajal, Advice to a Young Investigator. Mm-hmm. Looking back now, you're not particularly old, but you could at least give some advice to younger upcoming colleagues. What would it be?
Wow. Well, you know, I think certainly you have to be, you're going to do your best work when you're true to your passion and your vision. And that, my mother always raised me, she said, you know, you got to have a thick skin, you know, because you're going to come up against people who are going to tell you that what you're doing is wrong or it's not worth it or whatever. And you just got to have the confidence in yourself to say, you know, I believe it. I can't explain it, but I've got this sort of gut feeling about this. And I think if you have the confidence to pursue it, often you will succeed. And if not, you're going to learn a hell of a lot along the way, and it's going to get you on some path where you'll be successful. So I think having the confidence and the self-esteem is important. And, you know, I think for me, being a student of Rod Brooks, I think one of the most valuable things he taught me was to think about entire fields. I mean, they all have assumptions. You know, there are basic assumptions that there comes a time when people forget that they're making these assumptions, and breakthroughs are made when you can step back and reflect upon it and identify what that underlying kind of assumptions or set of assumptions might be, and you just tweak it a little bit. And that's when often you can open up a whole new field of inquiry. And in many ways, that's what I did with Kismet. It's like, well, let's think about people. Let's really think about people. We've pretty much ignored this whole social side, and it's going to be critical for social robots. Unfortunately, I came up with that at a time when the field was ready to think about it. I think if I did that 10 years earlier, people wouldn't have gotten it. But because people were already thinking about robots in society and people, they were, oh yeah, that is actually pretty important. We don't know much about that. So it was the right risk at the right time. But basically stepping back and thinking about, everybody's thinking about this set of problems and this way of thinking. And you just tweak that a little bit, and suddenly this whole new avenue can open up. And for me personally, that's where I want to be. I want to be in the new and the pioneering, pushing kind of in new questions, rather than kind of hammering away on the existing questions. I mean, I've always tended to gravitate towards, where's the exciting new territory? That's where I want to be.
Yeah. Have you talked, I just want to talk a little bit about this whole notion of the science of educating. Mm-hmm. And have you talked to Javier at all, Mavean, about the temporal dynamics of learning and so on, these issues that we deal with at the TDLC?
Yes, I mean, certainly, yeah.
So what's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends what you mean, but time is obviously a critical part in how we learn. And I mean, time is happening at, obviously, multiple scales. So, you know, even in this sort of interactional realm, the time in which you get feedback, the time of which you can, you know, associate a result to your action is going to play in a critical role in what you associate to be able to learn or not learn from that. And I think a lot of Javier's work has been exploring kind of what's that optimal window by which you associate this as a consequence of what you've done versus unrelated to that. Certainly when we talk about interpersonal interaction, contingency is really important. For children to be able to do something and have a contingent response is critical for them to start to be able to associate the consequences of their actions and feel that there's something for them to master, that they could start to predict. So versus kind of having this sort of correlation to the point of, I can make this effect happen, the temporal dynamics of that is really important. You know, to when we interact at an interpersonal level, we know things like building rapport and trust. A lot of that's based on the sort of temporal synchrony of bodies. So I have a collaboration now with colleagues of mine at Northeastern and Cornell, looking at the role of nonverbals in people's ability to predict how affiliative or how trustworthy a collaborator is in a sort of like, you know, prisoner's dilemma sort of task, where the amount of postural mirroring, so like if they touch their face in some way that you see the other person sort of touch their face, that this sort of mirroring and this sort of temporal correlation turns out is highly predictive of how you feel that other person is going to treat you in a sort of competitive slash cooperative task. So time enters into it in many, many, many levels, from this sort of sense of resonance and being like me and being affiliative, to being able to learn at this sort of low, you know, mechanical kind of learning mechanism level, to thinking about just, you know, how, you know, even motor trajectories unfold over time and how we interpret that in terms of expression. I mean, I think time is really pervasive in how we understand behavior.
I'm thinking though, as a parent, right? So you've got one, your oldest child's in kindergarten. So at some point you're going to embark on the giant school careers mm-hmm. business. From what you know now mm-hmm. about working in with robotics and education and so mm-hmm. on, there's a big debate going on about the education system
oh, yeah.
and how it's working, whether it's working and so yeah. on. Suppose I suddenly replaced Darnie Duncan with you and made you Secretary of Education. what kind of things might you even think about implementing?
I think, you know, when we certainly talk about what it's going to be like to be part of the workforce in the future, so the sort of 21st century workforce, there's already been large reports written about, you know, one of the most critical skills is going to be the ability to learn across your entire lifetime, to learn, to relearn, because technology is changing things so fast. You know, it's no longer you can learn a set of skills and have that last you your entire life. You have to keep being able to pick up new skills and so forth. So the ability to be really adept learners, I think, as a lifelong skill is going to be critical. And I think part of what we have to teach in our educational system is how to be a skillful learner, how to learn. I think that's absolutely critical. I think, you know, when we talk about the knowledge economy, you know, to be creative thinkers and problem solvers is going to be absolutely critical. And I think if we look at a lot of our formal education system, and it's not, you know, emphasizing kind of creativity and out-of-the-box thinking and problem-solving, and I think that's going to be a really critical skill. The ability to communicate and collaborate across disciplines is going to be a really critical skill. And we already see this in the field of in robotics and in other fields. A lot of the most challenging societal problems are going to be requiring the ability to interact with, collaborate, communicate with many people from many different disciplines, and that's going to be critical. I think if we can incorporate more curiosity-driven experiences where we nurture that spirit of curiosity and inquiry, where you get your hands dirty, you could go through an iterative cycle of conceptualize something, trying it out, testing it, learning from that, iterating again. I think that's a critical skill that we have to learn. I think there's a sort of media perception of, you know, you get the brilliant person and they go in the back room and they come up with this fabulous thing, it's their first try, and that's just not what it is, you know. There's so many iterations and failed attempts and learning from that and reflecting and incorporating that and trying the next thing. I mean, it's a whole process. We need to learn, teach our kids much more about the design process, the engineering process, I think, and how we approach creative thinking and problem solving. And I think we need to give our kids much more experiences to do that firsthand. I can tell you that, you know, when I was starting to do this in my own work, I mean, nothing is more rewarding than really getting in there and building something and exploring it and learning through that process of what works, what doesn't work. How does that make you think, what your assumptions were that might have been wrong? You know, I think it's really empowering in a lot of ways, and it's very creative in a lot of ways. And I think children thrive on their ability to be creative and to express that. And I think we could do a lot more in the kinds of experiences we offer kids in schools to really foster that.
We're thinking about the next Brains R Us, the meeting that we do from the Temple Dynamics Learning Center. Mm-hmm. and I had a conversation with Peter Diamandis, who's the CEO of the XPRIZE. And you know what that is. And the XPRIZE folks, I have been thinking about, and we are encouraging them to think more about what would be the metrics and the conditions and so on if you set up an XPRIZE for education. Because Peter Diamandis says you get what you incentivize. Now, the kind of things that you just were talking about are all exciting things. What's incentivized at the moment is, to some extent, people would say, rote learning and passing a test. Those are not the things you were talking about. You were talking about cross interdisciplinary thing, inventiveness, pushing the envelope and so on.
So, knowledge economy, yeah.
So, you know, let's imagine there's an X Prize for education. I mean, what are the things that we put down as the metrics and the proposal
Holy
for that?
Holy moly, yeah. These are big questions, Roger. I can't just spout these things off.
We ask big questions here on the Science Network.
I mean, I could tell you what, for me, the big audacious goal would be. I'm not sure how you would distill that down to a criteria.
What's the goal, then? The big audacious goal.
You know, I mean, for me, I think, you know, the big audacious goal would be, how do you spark curiosity, unleash creativity in every child on the planet, or every person on the planet, so they can feel empowered to build things to improve the world. So it's not just left to, oh, those people in universities, or oh, these people, you know, in corporations, but that everyone feels empowered and have the ability to contribute in that way, to improve their lives, because they feel that they have the skills and the abilities to think creatively and solve problems in different ways. I think that's huge. I think there's too many people who don't realize that they're capable of that, And I would like to see the educational system change in a way that every person feels that they do have something creative to contribute. Because I totally believe it. I totally believe it.
Okay. Let's imagine that you can have dinner with anybody in history. History of science, whatever, anybody alive, living, anybody that you would, whose example that you've read about or were inspired by, anybody that you would love to have met and sat and had a conversation with?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge with this question is, I mean, there's too many. You know, I think there's too many. You know, I think the kind of person who I would most hope to have that sort of experience would be someone who would really be able to pass on some real wisdom and experience and inspire me. I mean, it's, for me, it wouldn't be so much about what they've already accomplished, because, I mean, you know that, but it's more about, in that moment, what aha moment might I be able to glean from that interaction that could change my life. And, you know, that could come from any number of people, you know, but people who have really been able to think outside the box, to really break new ground, I think are the kinds of people who I most admire. And whether that's in the political sphere or the scientific sphere or the cultural sphere, the art sphere, I mean, I think...
That doesn't require anybody naming them. I get the general point. Your own, how many aha moments do you recall having had?
How many big aha moments? Sometimes you don't realize that they were actually the aha moment until long after the fact, and you look back and you go, ooh, that was actually pretty good. Sometimes you don't realize it in the moment. You know, sometimes if you're really working on a problem and you make a breakthrough, that's what happens. But sometimes you go on a path, and it's not until you make progress on the path and look back that you realize that was actually really significant. And you wonder, it's like, how did I have the audaciousness to even go in that direction? So, I mean, I think, you know, this area of social robotics was sort of that aha moment, where at the time it was a very practical thing in terms of robots in society. How the heck are people going to interact with these systems? You know, and it wasn't until, like, you know, I got pretty far into it that I realized, wow, this is actually an entirely unexplored, vast area of questions that people had never really thought of before in robotics. And so it really wasn't until significant time passed that I realized that was actually a big aha moment. And maybe that's more the spirit of my life, is the aha moment doesn't often happen in the moment that it happens. It happens down the road when you can start to see the impact of that. Because, you know, again, science and engineering, I mean, it's a lot of work, and it feels very incremental when you're doing it. And then you get far enough along where then you look back and go, oh, wow, I didn't realize how big that actually was, because you're in the moment and you see a lot of these, the work, the little bits and steps that it takes to get there.
Right, but you too.
I've never been so privileged to have the big giant leap all in when I've always had to do lots of little steps along.
You also talk about basically falling over and getting back up again. Yeah, I mean, what's the biggest mistake you ever made, and what did you learn from it?
The biggest mistake I ever made. Oh. It's hard for me to come up with what the biggest mistake would be, because again, I think a lot of it is more of being on a path and being nudged along directions, and you do a little bit here and it didn't quite work out, and you go in another direction. I mean, I haven't had a catastrophic failure that makes me really rethink my entire life, you know? It's more of these incremental shifts, and somehow you end up on a path that's an exciting and interesting path, and maybe some of that's kind of that gut feeling again of where you want to go. But I haven't had the sort of catastrophic moment that really causes me to have to really reflect deeply on what I, you know, where I was at the time. But lots of little failures, kind of like the little pebble, you know, like it's buffeted around. And
lots and of learns.
Lots of learns, lots of little mistakes, lots of learns, yeah.
When President Obama, at his inaugural, and later when he addressed the National Academies of Science, He used this phrase about restoring science to its rightful place. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to know what you think the rightful place of science is in this society.
I would love to see a time where science and engineering was as revered and aspired to as pop music is today, and, you know, actors and actresses are today. I would love to see the new rock stars, or at least a set of rock stars, be people who are exceptional, made exceptional contributions in science and engineering, that, you know, in other countries, they have those figures, and I would love to see that happen in the United States as well, that we really value that as a nation and understand that huge contributions to society are made by scientists and engineers and technologists, and that we review and we value that, and children aspire to that, really aspire to that. That's what I would hope.
That's a great answer. Now, what are you optimistic about?
You know, I think, you know, you go into science and engineering because you're an optimist, right? You go into these areas because you fundamentally feel that you can make the world a better place, you know, that your contributions, your knowledge, your new techniques that you come up with are gonna be applied to be able to improve the condition of people and the planet. I think it's fundamentally an optimistic endeavor. I think it's fundamentally also an endeavor where you're willing to be, you know, to understand that you could just be wrong. You know, that you may not actually ever know exactly what the right answer is, and that you could be wrong at any time. But you feel that effort and the path and the journey is gonna lead beneficial, fruitful things.
Okay, well, more fruitful things ahead of you, I hope. Cynthia Brazil, thank you very much.
You.